Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, this is Debbie Brock calling in today to the Blog Talk Radio Show, and we are normally simulcasting on Freedomizer Radio, Blog Talk Radio as well. There has been some technical problems getting onto that network, and thus we will broadcast from Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, and we are an affiliate of homeopathyworldcommunity.com. Alan Phillips will be with us shortly, as well as Greg Glazer, constitutional lawyer from California, discussing the typical topics of our day concerning vaccinations and the changing environment in vaccinations. I think so many people have begun to really investigate on their own and take matters into their own hands, searching for ways of promoting and maintaining their freedoms. So the plan for today is to speak with them, and I think this is Alan on the line right now. Are you with me?
I am in. Thank you for getting things started for us today.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead and take the first half hour and let us know what's on your mind concerning vaccines and the current events, and then I'll pop in about 30 minutes, and hopefully Greg Glazer will be with us as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Debbie. Really appreciate it. Today, I wanted to share for the first part of the show today and have a discussion about a topic that has come up several times in my practice recently and comes up intermittently from time to time throughout my years of practice and work with vaccine exemptions and waivers. And the subject has to do with the question of whether or not private schools have to accept a parent's vaccine religious exemption with regard to their minor children's school enrollment, or even college students who may be legal adults as well. Same question. And the first thing I want to say about this question generally is that I believe the answer can vary from state to state, depending on the specific wording of a state's laws. Now, there are several parts and pieces to this, some of them legal technicalities, some of them practical realities. But I guess I'd like to start first with just sort of some general comments about where I see this come up as an issue for parents. And really, most of the time that I have seen it in my practice has to do primarily with religious schools that would include Catholic schools and some Jewish schools. And I've recently heard from several people particularly in the state of Florida, but I've heard from people from all over the state of Florida, and apparently there are perhaps a few, if not several, different Catholic dioceses in Florida, and apparently some of them accept religious exemptions while others don't, which is rather confusing. Now, my co-host Debbie Brock and I are heard saying from time to time on this show that we don't give medical or legal advice, and I just want to reiterate that again. I'm going to offer some opinions, but not as legal advice, rather as educational information for people to consider. If you have a specific legal issue concerning vaccine exemptions and waivers or any other important legal matter, for that matter, it really is wise, if it's really an important issue for you, it's really wise to consult personally and privately a knowledgeable attorney, because every situation to one degree or another is unique, and your rights will vary not only according to the law in your jurisdiction or jurisdictions, but according to the facts and circumstances of each situation. So we can make some general assertions about law and rights, but ultimately it can vary with the specific facts and circumstances and the jurisdictions or laws are involved. But having said that, I have reviewed Florida's laws on the issue, and in some states it really is not crystal clear or immediately obvious from the laws whether or not private schools are obligated to, and by private I mean any non-public school, that could be religious schools or non-religious schools, and private schools, the definition, specific definition will vary from state to state, but here in North Carolina, homeschooling is a subset of private schools. And so really, if I think for general purposes here, we're talking about non-public schools when I say private schools, but in any event, inclusive of religious schools. And it is interesting that the Catholic schools throughout the state of Florida do not have a unified position on this question. But the statutes in Florida that I have looked at and regulations seem really very straightforward and clear on the issue that private schools must, in Florida, honor a religious exemption. And there are different things that are going on, potentially one or more of them in any given instance, when a private school refuses a religious exemption, even though legally they may be required to do so. It may be that school officials are seeing the issue as a theological question and taking the position essentially that, well, our religion isn't opposed to vaccines, so of course somebody attending our school, which is a school for a particular religion, whatever that religion may be in any given instance. So, of course, people attending our school can't have a religious exemption. As I have said, I'm sure, repeatedly in the past, vaccine religious exemptions, even though, of course, they involve religion and religious beliefs, is not a theological question. It's a legal question that has to do, what is the definition of religion under the law, as opposed to any other definition for any other purpose, and does the person applying for the exemption qualify? Well, under the First Amendment of the Constitution, doesn't matter what your church is, or even if you go to a church at all, it's your personal interpretation of your religion or your personal religious beliefs, as long as they are religious in nature, as the law defines that, which frankly is quite broadly, and as long as the beliefs are sincere. So a Catholic or school or Jewish school or any other Christian school or whatever religion it would be doesn't have the luxury, if you want to call it that, of deciding whether or not an individual parent's religious beliefs are valid in terms of is the religion opposed to vaccines or not, because legally that's up to the parents to decide for themselves. It's whatever their beliefs are, whether or not anybody else in the same religion shares the same beliefs. So it's not a theological question, it's a legal question. But there may be other things involved too. It could be that school officials are afraid of liability, but if someone has a legal right to exercise the exemption, there's not going to be any liability for the school in honoring the parent's legal right. They may be concerned about the health and safety of the unvaccinated child and whether that child is going to spread disease to others in the school, but that doesn't make sense medically or legally. Medically, we know from the CDC's website that 5-15% of vaccinated children don't get immunity from the vaccines. And nationally, it just saw very recent figures, the national average for exemptions, and I think this was all exemptions, but in any event, at the kindergarten level, the national average is 1.8%. Far, far fewer non-vaccinated students than there are non-immune vaccinated students. So if they really have a concern about somebody's immune status, they need to test all those vaccinated kids and figure out who the 5 to 15% of them are that are not immune, because those are the kids who are far greater in number than the non-vaccinated kids. And the non-vaccinated kids may not be lacking immunity. The CDC tells us, of course, this is common sense, that non-vaccinated people can get natural immunity. What is not as widely known, but is stated on the CDC's website, is that you can get natural immunity without even developing symptoms. So you don't have to get a measles rash to be immune from measles, and you don't have to get a vaccine or have that illness in terms of a rash and be sick and home in bed to be immune from the measles. So the bottom line is that vaccination is not a reliable indicator of immune status. And yet many people blindly accept this medically and scientifically false, fear-based propaganda that if you're vaccinated, you're fine. If you're unvaccinated, you're going to kill everybody. It's just not true. It just doesn't work that way. Vaccination is not about the immune status of individuals, because vaccination is not a reliable indicator of the immune status of any given individual. What vaccination is about, in theory, is groups of people, specifically the so-called herd immunity theory that tells us that so long as most people in a population are vaccinated, everybody's going to be protected. Now, the validity of that theory is a separate question. Let's put that aside for the moment. But let me just repeat this concept again, because this is something that's right out of mainstream medicine, right off the CDC's own website. But medical doctors don't understand this. School officials don't understand this. And probably most parents, for that matter, as well. And the actions and behaviors of our officials, school officials, medical authorities, is contradictory to this well-established mainstream medicine reality, as asserted by the authority of all authorities on the subject, at least in the eyes of the mainstream, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, federal agency that looks out for the well-being of people not only here in the U.S., but well beyond its authority to that of the rest of the world. Another separate issue there to discuss at another time. Vaccination, I want to repeat this, vaccination under mainstream theory and beliefs is not concerned with the immune status of individuals. Vaccination policy concerns the immune status of groups, because vaccination status does not reliably tell you anything about the immune status of any given individual. As long as most people in a population are vaccinated, it is presumed medically, and should be presumed legally as well, and I think it is presumed legally when you look at the exemption laws, that all members of that population are protected. So, but the behavior of authorities is contrary to this. For example, more and more pediatricians are just flat out refusing to treat unvaccinated children at all, even if the parents have a religious exemption or some other valid state exemption. So when a state passes an exemption law, when a legislature passes an exemption law, that law carries with it a legal presumption that it's safe to exercise the exemption, or else the legislature wouldn't have given us that right. So when a pediatrician refuses to treat an unvaccinated child, they are disagreeing with the state legislature. They are trying to say, I know better than the state legislature. Frankly, I don't think either of them knows anything sensible at all about vaccination, but as a general proposition, always exceptions, of course, but as to legal status, pediatricians do not have authority to overrule state legislatures. It's just not how the system works. If they disagree with the state legislature, they certainly are free in their expert opinion to do that, but if they want to deal with the legislature's opinion, they need to go back to the legislature and say, look, you need to repeal or fix this exemption law because it's putting people at risk. And if that's what they believe, that's what they need to do. But you don't take it out on the parents. The parents are just exercising their legal right given to them by the state legislature. Doesn't matter whether you disagree with the parents, because the parents aren't the ones that pass the law, at least not the parents individually. Indirectly, of course, they elected the officials who did pass the law. But the point here is that doctors are overstepping ethical boundaries and maybe in some instances legal boundaries when they refuse to accept a parent's exemption and allow the child to be seen, and see the child, despite their not being vaccinated. But it doesn't make any sense medically, and this is really the bigger point to me, that here are who knows how many thousands, tens of thousands or more pediatricians around the country who are supposedly experts in, among other things, vaccination for infants and children. And yet they contradict the mainstream medicine and science with their practice when they refuse to treat unvaccinated children. And they make these medically absurd assertions that the unvaccinated kids are going to put people at risk, not acknowledging the clear mainstream scientific reality that you cannot presume a person's immune status by their, an individual's immune status by their vaccination status, and furthermore that you don't need to figure that out. We don't need to go test every vaccinated and unvaccinated kid to see who has antibodies to which diseases. Some of both the vaccinated and unvaccinated people, if tested, would show immunity and some would not. You'd see both results in both camps. That's not the point. If you believe in the mainstream herd immunity theory, it doesn't matter about individuals. What matters is groups. What matters is that most people are vaccinated, not that any given individual is or isn't vaccinated. So there's just huge hypocrisy and fear-based tactics about immunization that are really about money, because doctors are paid to maximize the immunization status. It's all about money and other agendas. It's not about health. That's a false pretense. And whether or not any given doctor knows that or is conscious of that is anybody's guess, but that's what's happening, whether they're doing it on purpose or not. The almighty dollar is there to direct and sway policy. So, let me see if I can reel myself in a little bit, back to the original topic of private schools. So I think, my impression is, I've not looked at every state's laws on this point, but my impression is that most states probably, the laws probably apply to public and private schools. But the question is, how do we know the answer to that question? And in some cases, the state law is very clear and straightforward on it. And I believe in Florida, that's the situation there. The law is very clear on it. So for whatever reason or reasons, some of the Catholic dioceses are opposed to accepting immunizations. And here's the sad reality about any exemption and waiver issue, whether you're talking about schools, public, private, homeschool, college, military, military families, immigrants, the legal ones at least have to be vaccinated, healthcare workers or other employees, whatever the context, it's the people who are requiring immunization or requiring an exemption who hold the leverage. At the end of the day, if they choose to behave unreasonably, if they choose to take what attorneys sometimes call the "so sue me" position, think you have a right, sue me. You know, but nobody works here unless they get a vaccine, or nobody goes to school here unless they get a vaccine, and so forth. That if they disagree with you about your right, or even if they agree with you but just want to make you jump through hoops to exercise your rights, they can do that. And it looks like that might be what's happening in certain parts of Florida with regard to the Catholic schools. Some of them are accepting exemptions. Why would they accept them if they didn't have to? I mean, there are reasons, but it seems to me unlikely in most cases that a school would accept exemptions if they didn't have to. Because if they didn't have to and they accepted it, there might be a legitimate liability concern. So are different diocese attorneys coming up with different answers? Are different dioceses just deciding they don't care what the law is, this is how we're going to do it? Sue me if you think you have a right. And how many parents will really sue a school to make the school accept their child? Do you really want your child going to a school that you had to sue to force them to accept your child? And can they just say, we're not going to accept you for some other reason or for no reason because it's a private school? See, a lot of times private entities can do at least some of what they want to because they're private. It may be that they can't unlawfully reject you because of not being vaccinated if the law says they have to accept the exemption. But can they just say no for some other reason? You know, does a private school even have to justify their choice not to enroll you? I'm not going to offer a definitive answer for every private school in the country, but there may be some latitude there. I know this is the case with many private hospitals or other private employers. They can't fire their employee lawfully if the employer, for not vaccinating, if the employee has a lawful right to refuse vaccines. But they could theoretically fire the employee in many cases for no reason or for some other reason that they decide. I'm happy to report that after having worked with, give or take, something on the order of 200 healthcare workers around the country in at least 26 different states over the last 3 years, I've only heard one report where one of my clients claimed that after getting the exemption with my help, 2 weeks later he was fired, and he is just adamant, he's positive that it was about the vaccine issue. Of course, he can't prove that. It would be unlawful for them to do it because of the vaccine issue. But it's an entirely separate question about whether or not somebody can prove that. Many employees around the country, many healthcare worker employees, are what are called at-will employees. They can't be fired for an unlawful reason, but they can be fired for no reason. So it's a difficult situation. Many, many healthcare workers won't even ask for an exemption because they're afraid they'll be singled out and fired. Of course, that will not be the reason given, but that'll really be what it's about. Well, I don't blame them for having that concern. It's a valid concern, but I am happy to say that it seems that less than 1% or fewer, I guess it would be less than 1% of my clients, fewer than 1%. We'll get a grammarian on to tell me which one of those is. I'm having confusion on at the moment. But it's a very small percentage of my clients who have reported to me that they were fired or believe they were fired for having asked for an exemption. So it seems to me, based on that as at least a starting point, reference point, seems unlikely that most people would be fired for daring to ask for an exemption. But many, many healthcare workers share that concern. I've heard that echoed all over the country. I've seen Jewish schools, private schools, similarly, in some instances, refuse religious exemptions while under law in a particular state they're required to. And so the issue comes up, and it seems to me, as I have said in general terms, that the pro-vaccine agenda is playing out rapidly and aggressively on multiple levels, everything from Obamacare down to individual schools and everything in between, and at state levels and the federal level and so forth and so on, while at the same time I see what, to me, sort of a cautious, optimistic view that there seems to be growing awareness about vaccines and more people not only becoming aware of vaccines, but more and more of those who are becoming aware taking some kind of step or action to refuse vaccines for their children or for themselves. And while it's a small percentage of the larger group of parents who have some awareness and concern, a small but growing number of people becoming legislatively active. And I can't stress how important that is, because where the rubber meets the road here, folks, is in the laws. And laws are being passed requiring more vaccines, allowing more people to give vaccines, allowing new groups of people to be required to get vaccines. This agenda is rolling forward. And where it is most troubling to me is when laws are passed that further the aggressive vaccine industry, because the net result of that is that more people are harmed with impunity to the people who are knowingly causing the harm, and most particularly executives in the pharmaceutical industry and at least some people in the state and federal health agencies. And they know that more harm is being caused, injury and death. They know it's being caused needlessly, and they are profiting enormously from this, and no one's being held accountable for it. All these laws in place that remove liability from anyone involved with any of this. So while spearheading a legislative project is an enormous undertaking, the National Vaccine Information Center provides a means by which parents and others can be involved with significant effect at a minimum of time. So I encourage people to go to the NVIC's advocacy portal, the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal. This is a nonprofit organization. It's been around for, 25 to 30 years at this point, advocating for parents of injured vaccine-injured children or adults who have been injured, and for the right to make informed choices regarding vaccines. Wonderful organization. The website is nvicadvocacy.org. nvicadvocacy.org. And that's a place where you can stay up to date with what's going on with vaccine legislation nationally in states around the U.S., but also where you can sign up and find information about what you can do in your state when there's an action item, legislation to support or oppose, as the case may be, and become actively involved to help promote informed choice where vaccines are concerned at the legislative level in your state. Minimum amount of time, but ways to be involved where you can help make a difference, and I really do encourage folks to do that. We are closing in on the end of the first half hour mark, and my wonderful co-host, Debbie Brock, back on the line. Debbie, terrific to have you back here.
Right. I hope you're feeling relaxed. You don't have to do any commercial breaks. You'll have to talk a little bit longer, or you feel less rushed.
Well, you know that's going to be hard for me to figure out, anything to say to fill the space, but somehow, some way, I feel sure I can do that. Actually, I was kind of hoping that you and Greg would do a little more of the talking today. I've been having some voice trouble recently, and it looks like it's not going to ease up quickly just because I'm having to continually use my voice. But
okay. Well, I have opened the chat just now. Not really realizing that I hadn't done it earlier. For anybody who wants to call in and say something at 347-945-6956 or get on the chat and place your comments. This has really been a wonderful show today so far. I think a lot of really important main ideas that people might not realize is that how the government looks at vaccinations, not about your individual child or your individual status of immunity, but as a group, as a herd or a mass of people, and not realizing that, you know, the group is made up of individuals, and we have to look closely at our individual stories to know what is safe and proper for each person, what an individual can accommodate in terms of their health, what kinds of implications or triggers might cause an individual to become sicker rather than healthier. So the fact, as people are now learning the ingredients of what are in vaccinations, they are taking a second look. And I did recently look at that Scream, you know what I'm talking about. That's Dr.
The Scream of the Week.
The Scream of the Week with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, is it? And
yes.
July 26th, she had one. And she was screaming about the adjuvants that are added to the seasonal influenza vaccine. And they did a study on the elderly, modeling the immunogenicity from a randomized trial. Those are big words that are basically saying that they took a look at the participants in this study who used diary cards to record the occurrences of, I guess you would say, reactions in the body to the intensity of the reactions at the injection site. These adverse events, which would be bleeding, pain, redness, swelling to this local site, and systemically arthralgia, fatigue, headache, myalgia, nausea, shivering, fever, things that would, you might say, well, you might as well get the flu. And basically, she looked at the numbers, and it said the percentage of the participants reporting at least one local symptom ranged from 38.7 to 67.7. That's in the adjuvant group. So the vaccine that contained these extra ingredients we call adjuvants to stimulate the immune system had a pretty high rate of a local reaction. And in the non-adjuvant group, there was 18% reported a symptom. So you're comparing 38 to 67.7 to 18%, and 48.8 in the non-adjuvant group. So much lower response, adverse event. And her conclusion is the new thing in flu shots is to add an adjuvant, a chemical that increases the amount of antibody produced by a vaccine. And I think you were mentioning earlier that you really can't tell very much, even if a person has an antibody, to their health status. The two used most widely are MF59 and AS03. These, she has, if you want to go to Dr. Tenpenny's Vaccine Research Library, you can learn more about those adjuvants. And the flu shot alone can cause side effects, but those vaccines with the adjuvants, up to 67% of all subjects in the study had at least one symptom that ranged from mild to severe. And so her scream is that as if vaccines were not bad enough all by themselves, why do the manufacturers insist on adding a chemical that can cause even more devastating side effects? And I would like, I'm giving you a chance to just listen in and not speak. Oh, it looks like we might have a guest. We might have Greg on the line with us. Hey, Greg, are you there? I just noticed that you're with us. So have you been able to hear so far?
Yes.
Do you have any comments about Dr. Tenpenny's scream?
Oh, I just checked in the last few minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, she was she has this special blog where she screams about something, and I can understand that when something goes wrong in your life, in your household, with your health, with your children's health, all you want to do is scream. I mean, it's the biggest and greatest release that you can have physically, you know, like a kind of a self-therapy, is to just scream and yell. And that's how probably so many parents must feel after an adverse event, because, you know, you could pull your hair out. What can you do? You want to protect your child. And she's saying, based on actual scientific randomized trial, that persons age 65, the elderly in this randomized trial, had adverse events, much higher adverse events, 38.7 to 67.7, in the group of influenza vaccines that contained adjuvants, as opposed to 18.7 to 45.8% in the non-adjuvant group, and that's ages 18 to 40. So that kind of covers that scream. What do you think about this idea that Dr. Tenpenny has?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. There are a couple of human psychological conditions that will lead to screaming, obviously one being fear. And, you know, what I think that oftentimes we speak from our heart, and that, you know, responding with a scream is definitely something that can come out on a, like on a personal level. And I think if it's kept in that realm of just being, you know, this is my personal, you know, psychological or emotional reason that I felt like I wanted to express this. And, yeah, that makes sense.
You know what?
In terms of therapy, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, you know, and in terms of the psychological like weight that, you know, that it puts upon us, screaming is a way to let it out, but there's something that that is very difficult for us to release as people, and that is the feeling of regret. And regret can be a great motivator throughout our lives. We sort of lack the ability to forgive ourselves, because we can't forgive ourselves. We have to have the victim forgive us, you know, if we are the offender. And if you are the parent, you know, and you vaccinated your child and they had a condition and it was based on, you know, your ignorance and not realizing that you were putting poison into your child, you know, you're going to carry that regret. It has to be, you know, perhaps your child that can give you for that. And there's just a lot of uncertainty. But, yeah, I think fear and regret are great motivators in our world.
Wow, this stimulates a really good discussion, because I just had, on the Health In show, I had Gina Tyler talking to us about her pediatric clinic situation this summer in Thailand, and how they do mandatory vaccinations, and the parents really carry the weight of the guilt and everything else that goes along with it for children who have been injured. One other point that came up, and that is when you think about this scream, that's what happens to a child after vaccination. They have a high-pitched scream. And maybe that is really where she got the idea from.
Oh, it's terrible. When my wife and I vaccinated our daughter for the first round of vaccinations, I'll tell you. Let me just get to the good point. We realized after the first round that, you know, what we were doing, we stopped. But it's ingrained in my mind. Debbie, that scream that you're talking about, and it is screams, and it goes on. And what they do is you go in, you have to hold down your child physically, because there's just one nurse with a, you know, just this pantry of needles, and they just go one after the other, and you're forcing your child down, and they are just literally screaming, and, you know, it's basically, you know, everyone in the room is crying on some level, and it's mm-hmm. just terrible. It's wrong.
It's screaming.
You know, when it's happening, but there's this system in place where, you know, the person that is injecting the poison into your child is wearing this, you know, very clean white coat, and it's very, you know, authority. You just filled out a bunch of forms. It's so official that, you you know, all of your instincts that, you know, are telling you that this is wrong is counterbalanced by the, you know, by the institution that tells you that, that it's okay. And that conflict is part of our human drama. And I'm hopeful that in all of the regret that we have and all the pain, that we can use it as some kind of like soil foundation for growing something better. You know, sometimes because of a painful background, or problems that we learn how to be better people. I just watched I'll just draw an analogy. When the war on drugs started, there was definitely a consensus that, you know, we need to stop these harmful drugs. Then 30 years later, when you look at the war on drugs and the statistics, you know, you start to see that it carries with it these real problems, and we're not actually making traction. I think we could say the same thing with vaccines. You know, maybe there was a time when they thought, well, let's give it a try and see, you know, see how it works. But today, shouldn't we know better? Shouldn't we see? And we can see entire institutions have grown up around the war on drugs, just as they've grown up around the vaccine industry. These are very dangerous institutions. And what history shows us is that when you create an institutional beast, it falls hard, and it's very difficult to change it from within, and often from without. And sometimes entire battles need to be fought, both on a legal battle, and sometimes it even gets into physical battles, which is terrible. And if we try to rely on the law alone to fix these issues, I think that it'll be falling on deaf ears. And because politics and the law work together. And so I think what Pandemic Response Project is doing to promote change from the legislative area as well as from the legal area is just really a step in the right direction for where we can go, consolidating our political will to make change. And it takes a lot. You know, it takes documentaries. It takes experienced attorneys working in this area, and it takes political activists. And I'm glad to be here on the radio show today to talk about it.
And you are absolutely a part of that, and a powerful contributing force, Greg. Pleasure as always to have you back with us today. I wanted to make a couple of clarification points on early parts of the discussion that Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, some months ago, put together what she's calling a vaccine library, where she is collecting on an ongoing basis peer-reviewed published medical studies that document the harm and vaccines cause and the problems with vaccines. You know, anytime somebody says, medical literature proves that vaccines are safe, that's absurd. Dr. Tenpenny has something on the order, give or take, of 5,000 studies, and she's adding to that every week. And in connection with her growing library of peer-reviewed published vaccine medical studies, she pulls out one study each week that she calls the Scream of the Week. So the Scream of the Week is whatever study on any given week that has come to her attention that is just outrageous for one reason or another. There probably are more than one every week, but she'll pick the worst one, if you want to think of it that way, or one of the worst ones, or one of the most striking ones, and it gets the title, the honorary title of Scream of the Week, because of what it reveals about how absurd vaccine policy and law is, ultimately, even if the study itself is not explicitly addressing that question, but by implication is doing that. So just wanted to sort of let people understand about that, because this vaccine library is accessible on the Internet, and anyone can join it for free for a limited period of time and download and search for any studies about any particular vaccine or vaccine issue that they would like. And because there is an ongoing cost to Dr. Tenpenny for establishing, maintaining, and building on an ongoing basis this library, then there is a fee to stay a member of it over the long term. But I encourage anybody who wants to have the power of an ability to search the medical literature on this specific issue, vaccines and problems with vaccines. Boy, there's probably no better way to get to that information quickly and directly than Dr. Tenpenny's vaccine library. So I really encourage folks to go check it out, and you can test it out for free. And especially anyone who wants information on an ongoing basis or who wants to keep tabs or keep up with what's going on in the medical literature, excellent project to join and support financially as well, so that Sherry can keep on pulling together this information and providing it. But Greg, we've taken a detour here, a very wonderful detour, but I think a detour nonetheless. If in fact you came in today prepared with a particular topic or focus, so I want to turn the show back over to you with that question, and if indeed you had a specific topic or focus for us today, go ahead and tell us what that is and where you'd like to go with it.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you for that opportunity. What I'd like to focus on today is the topic of forceful medication, and I'd like to propose a couple of solutions to our current legal predicament, which is that there is an uncertainty over when law enforcement can forcefully medicate someone. And so I have a couple of solutions to that problem, and I wanted to present what they are and then just basically get your guys' feedback about that. And so the first one is, I thought about preparing a chart for law enforcement, and the chart would advise law enforcement when they are allowed to forcefully medicate versus when they are not allowed to forcefully medicate. And in this chart, it's a flow chart, and it shows the procedure that they must follow if they do forcefully medicate. And I thought that would be helpful for law enforcement because in my experience working with people in government who are charged with administering the laws, whether it's a mayor or whether it's a police chief, they rely on summary sheets from attorneys. They're not going out and reading cases. And I think that a sheet that presents a flow chart would be a useful tool in the hands of those who understand the balance between individual rights and also the government's duty of law enforcement and the government's power under what's called the police power. And so I wanted to gather your guys' thoughts on if you thought that would be a helpful tool to put in the hands of law enforcement and then the best method to distribute a flowchart.
Well, I certainly think the basic idea sounds absolutely wonderful. One of the first things I wonder is, would local law enforcement be looking to or receptive to private attorneys as opposed to the quote-unquote official state source, which would presumably be state health department or perhaps a local county health department? Any thoughts about that? And I see Debbie is back in with us too, so I'm looking forward to hearing what her thoughts as well.
Do you want me to comment now?
Greg, do you want to respond to my comment first?
Yeah.
Just so we
sure.
get too much on the table played at one time here?
Yeah, I think that a chart that comes from a private attorney would definitely come within a realm of being just a private opinion. It doesn't even rise to the level of a law review, which is published and peer-reviewed document. It's a public journal on a regular basis. So I think that would be the channel presented through would be in media, as well as it could be proposed to certain legislative councils. Like, for example, there are councils all over the country that are going to be deciding on forced medication issues. It definitely comes up in the emergency arena, as well as in arenas of, like, prisoner rights and so forth. And I think that when those councils get together, you know, for their official discussion, presenting them with the flowchart is a way to get it into the public discourse in a way that it can, if accepted by a legislative official, it can be recognized, become part of the debate. And then the more that it is recognized and cited, you know, as a source of source of useful knowledge and set it in a, especially in a bipartisan way, then it, it starts to take on some authority. Obviously, there's not going to be a substitute for an official paper that comes from like the CDC. You know, that's they're the ones charged with a lot of responsibility under our emergency management laws for medicine. But I think that one of the principles of our government is to have checks and balances where we are constantly making sure that the CDC's opinions do not become the official gospel of all government, responsibilities and individual rights, because that's just too much power. And so, and I think that the legislature understands that on some level, or, you know, legislatures would understand that on some level and would be receptive to a chart like that. So what are your thoughts on that, Debbie?
I think that your answer really covered anything that I might have said in terms of question. I think that as many people need to be involved in the discussion as possible. And when you do have something that's concrete and visual and something that people, it's an educational tool, basically, to have that flowchart that you're speaking of. And I think it would be awesome if you did put it together so that people could learn from it tangibly and fix it in their mind. And then maybe that would bring up new questions that need to be answered or new approaches or people with innovation. So I think it's good to have as many tools as possible. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing that I was thinking of as well is that the flowchart could be the product of collaboration. For example, mm-hmm. started off as a draft flowchart prepared by, you know, me as a private attorney, but then it was stayed as a draft until it received collaboration with others, other attorneys across the nation, as well as official counsel. And you know, I think it might start to pick up ways.
That sounds good. And so then as many different viewpoints would have a say in it, rather than
right.
coming only from one point of view.
Exactly. And that's so important to remain objective in the analysis, because there are some uncertain questions here with regard to what the where the law stands. And I've quoted other legal scholars, for example, I'll quote Renee Doplick here, where she concluded in her law review from 2008 called Emergency Preparedness for a Pandemic Under International Law. And she emphasized that, quote, the right of a coercive international intervention in response to an infectious outbreak remains uncertain and untested under international law, and if invoked, should be limited to extraordinary circumstances. And I think that that would be received well by those promoting the vaccine agenda and those opposed to the vaccine agenda, because there is an uncertainty there. And I think that in presenting the rules to law enforcement, they're going to be receptive to using caution. They don't want to go out and force medicate every member of the public. You know, they're not going to be jumping at that opportunity. And so I think that it will be receptive to what has already been proposed, even by staunch militarists, which is some due process protection and forceful medication, at the very least hearings and so forth.
Right, because yeah. I think the problem occurs when, I don't want to call it a complacency or acceptance, but once something is more out there a little bit more, it's not a one-time event, it's not, as you say, limited to extraordinary circumstances, it becomes, well, let's cover all bases and make it and generalize and then give it sway to have these kinds of actions on an everyday basis. And that's, I think, a concern. So how do we keep something that should be only used for limited, unusual circumstances from becoming just let's accept this for everyday circumstance?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know where I'm getting at with that? It's not just, okay, emergency preparedness, but preemptively do this to everybody for this reason. And people just accept it in the way that I was just visiting a pharmacy for something simple like hydrogen peroxide. And as you're walking in, there's the sidewalk with five different banners. And I think I mentioned this on the last show. You know, get your malaria vaccine, get your whooping cough vaccine, get your influenza. I mean, it went on five different banners, and I'm going like, is this absurdity? Is this crazy? I mean, why would anybody do this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the official platform presents these vaccines as being part of a standard medicine, which it is, unfortunately, and that's where people gravitate towards. And
mm-hmm.
in America, people also gravitate toward individual rights, which is certainly positive. And so these two opposing forces are always kept in check. And as one legal commentator in a published law review recently said that, you know, when it really comes down to it, forced vaccination is forcing someone to use a corporation's product. That was an interesting way to put it. I hadn't thought of that before. And, you know, it's true. These are pharmaceutical entities that are preventing these vaccines. It's not only forcing them to use a corporation's product, it's forcing them to use a corporation's product that can be shown to cause harm and often does not work. In my opinion,
Let's not forget that we're talking about corporations that routinely engage in criminal behavior and get fines.
Constantly fined. Yeah, that's right. And
criminal fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars and as high as $1 billion in a couple of instances. I had a short temporary disconnect pulled on the court.
When these pharmaceutical companies are not being fined, they are under investigation. And where they're not under investigation, they are the subject of scathing books and documentaries and articles constantly investigating their activities. Whistleblowers are coming out on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis. Organization.
Can you repeat that? Because I'm kind of coming in and out with the sound. Are you able to hear me? No. Yes, you are. So can you just repeat what you just said, Greg, for emphasis?
Yeah, sure. What we have is where these corporations are constantly being fined. When they're not being fined, they're under investigation. And when they're not under official investigation, they're at least the subject of documentaries exposing their activities, whistleblowers coming out on a regular basis, and an article as well. And anyone who has even one eye open can see that there are serious questions with regard to the conduct and the product of these pharmaceutical companies. So if government comes in and has both eyes shut, or maybe perhaps the great eye in the pyramid open to see what's really happening, then and they mandate it, you know, upon the people, I think what we have is some serious tyranny there. And what the American public are supposed to do when faced with tyranny is put it down. And when lawyers are charged with a great responsibility in that regard, do that, which I think maybe is a good segue for my second solution that I'd like to propose to fix this problem.
Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of static there on the line. Do we know where that's coming from? Sounds like tapping.
Oh.
Yeah, we have some key clicks there.
Okay. All right. So, the second solution that I'm proposing is a referenda, which is a proposed law by the people. And it's called PANDA, the Peaceful and Natural Dignity Act. And the referendum is designed to protect against the forced medication of the most endangered creature in America. You guys know who the most endangered creature in America is? Or do you have a guess?
This sounds like a trick question, but I'd have to say that humans are right up there somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. In my opinion, it's the peacefully natural human. I can find all sorts of humans on this in our country who are neither peaceful nor natural. They are, in a sense, almost like chemical weapons, walking around filled with chemicals, and they are not peaceful. They vote. They vote for leaders who promote war. They purchase products that promote the exploitation of people and planet. And so it is hard to find peacefully natural humans, but I think they are out there. I'm not claiming to be one, but I think that one of our jobs as a body politic is to protect those who are most vulnerable among us. And you can look to, for example, the quotes of Chief Justice Warren. And he emphasized that very well, that a society is tested by how it treats its lowest class of members or its least protected members. And I think the peacefully natural human, where we can find them, is that member. The first peacefully natural human that comes to my mind is the baby. Every single baby that's born is coming out peaceful and, I hope, natural. And we need to give them, and we need to give their parents the right to protect their dignity. And that means the right to avoid forced vaccination, forced medical treatment. And so what I have in this referendum is I wrote out a proposed law for states. And the reason that it's a state law and not a federal law is because historically and by cases, the public health protection comes through the state level and not the federal level. There's a lot of exceptions there, but no need to go into detail. In any case, it's a state referendum where I can go into some of the particulars of the law, but the first thing that you probably want to know is, what do I mean by peacefully natural? So I have a definition. It's pretty short, so I'll quote it for you. Okay. Peacefully natural refers to a manner of being that causes no actual, material, or unjust harm, or individually calculable material and unjust threat to another living being, and which is a fundamental expression of the individual human condition. So what does that mean? Basically, in my mind, I'm thinking of a baby or an Indian who's living on a reservation, an organic homesteader who is growing his own food, a person who is an activist, like the Peace Pilgrim, for example, would be another person. And so Forrest Gump was very peacefully natural, wasn't he, when he was walking across the country? And so although peacefully natural people are hard to find, they are out there, and this referendum is designed to protect that right to remain peacefully natural. And so within this referendum, it also encourages people to become peacefully natural, to see the virtues of it. And I think that the definition of peacefully natural would also evolve over time with the society that understands what it means, because some may find that there's more to being this quality of peacefully natural other than just, you know, like you have to live off the land and eat berries and, you know, have a hut. Not like it could be more than that. And so I think it just encourages debate on that. And I think that's a better debate to have than where the debate is currently. And so that's one of my goals in proposing this referendum. And the way that I'm going to present this referendum to the public is through a website called change.org. If you go to change.org, you'll find petitions that are commanding actual change in the world, where it could be any person that posts a proposal for change or they highlight an issue, and whether it's a corporate issue or a government issue, and they will basically gather signatures on their proposal, and then it automatically commands the attention of the whoever is the subject of the petition. People have put out petitions against corporations for things like bad cell phone bills. They put out petitions to actually change local government. And if you get enough signatures, if you get enough interest in your petition, the corporation or the legislature will respond to it, either officially through meeting, or they will at least try to dodge the issue. And what this does is it creates a debate. It creates political will in one direction. And so my goal is to present this for California and take it from there, and then also include other states. So this would be a model for presenting this situation. And one of the ways that I have drafted the proposal is in regard to examples. So I look at the way that official government lawyers are claiming the right to forcibly medicate. And the idea is, and this is what I found, that they acknowledge that they can't forcibly vaccinate or medicate, but in the event that there is a pandemic or an emergency, then a person can be quarantined during the public health emergency. It gives rise to the vaccination order, the forced medication order. And you can find that official position in a paper. For example, mandatory vaccination, precedent and current laws, February 2011 by the Congressional Research Service. So that's an official paper of the Congressional Research Service where they're laying out their position. And so what I'm trying to do is challenge that by preserving the right in individuals and families to not only refuse forced medication, but also during a public health emergency, to be able to self-quarantine together on private land so that in the event you do have a Gestapo type of relationship between public health authorities and the public, that there is some legal protection and some boundaries. And if the state of Germany had this law that I'm proposing during World War II, things may have been very, very different. And I think that one of my skills is to be able to see the writing on the wall and then present solutions. One of the things that is not my skill is being able to mobilize individuals to enact change. And so that's where I see the power of change.org to be a vehicle for getting this idea out to the public and having people comment on it and talk about it. So I'm preparing, I've prepared not only the proposed law, prepared a summary sheet, and I'm also preparing a video to basically explain in short summary, what I'm proposing, because I found that it would be very difficult to get people interested in actually reading the text of proposed laws, which are officially proposed to them when elections come around. And people are not actively going out and seeking to read proposed laws that are not being presented for their official vote. Would you guys agree with that that summary, that people are not actively going out to try to vote on referendum? It's really not even something that's talked about much.
You know, Greg, I think part of the underlying condition that allows a number of different private or personal agendas to be forwarded even when or even though they're opposed to the public's well-being has to do with so many of us doing all we can just to get through the day and get home and get fed and get groceries and do the laundry and so forth, that it's difficult to get people, and there are so many different issues that are of potential concern to society at large. And to get people's attention on any one of them and then go a step further to get them to act on it any further. It's one of the reasons I am so happy to see so many different organizations, for example, advocating for awareness and reform with regard to alternative health issues. You know, different organizations that are promoting GMO labeling, for example. And to be able to get on their list and to have them bring to my attention by way of email here's an issue in this state. You know, this state has a bill they're introducing or so forth. And, you know, here's something you can do. Click this link and sign a petition. I can take a few seconds to click a link and sign a petition any day of the week, you know, and I'm happy to do so. You know, for issues that I'm aware of and so forth. But, you know, I'm sort of contradicting my initial point where I'm saying, you know, who has time to be aware of all these things, let alone to keep up and act on it? And yet the Internet has helped substantially to counteract that deficit. So, you know, it's a matter of degrees and so forth. But it's difficult, I think, for most people, and I think this is a reason why many people are either completely unaware or minimally aware of a myriad of different issues that are ones that ideally we should all have some awareness of and be acting on or speaking out about.
Yeah, and I think it becomes difficult because these issues often are not personal to them. I mean, I have a hard time imagining something that could be more personal than your right to, you know, bodily integrity. But it's true, you know, that these, you know, if it's not on your plate, if you're not thinking about it regularly, you're not likely to even maybe even open an email or even receive an email about something like this, a petition like this, because maybe you don't associate with others you talk about, you know, issues like this. So
exactly.
Yeah. So how does one get this issue on the radar?
Deb, you're breaking up, and we're not. I don't know if it's for you, true for you, Greg. I'm not hearing what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's completely breaking up, Debbie.
Debbie, I would recommend just hanging up and calling back in. And Alan, on that point, you know, the California Supreme Court, the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court have all come out and said that the right to be free from non-consensual invasions of bodily integrity is not absolute. So, you know, the right to refuse medical treatment is not absolute. And the examples that they give where they are, you know, trying to carve out where a government can invade. I mean, it's like if you're a prisoner, you know, in an institution, then they have the right to make some medical decisions on your behalf. They've also had other things like preventing suicide, maintaining the integrity of the medical profession, protecting innocent third parties, and preserving life. And these examples, it just shows that these courts will look at difficult cases, you know, where someone will not be in their right mind, for example, or they don't have the ability to make medical decisions on their own behalf. And then they'll try to carve out a rule, like something, a very extreme statement, like the right to refuse medical treatment is not absolute. But then you can also find Supreme Court cases that say that this is one of the highest rights in our society. And the fundamental right of self-determination to refuse or demand the withdrawal of medical treatment is a quote. So what I see in particular is competing interests. So perhaps that's just our destiny. It's to be in this constant flux, this battle for rights. And you just hope that in this battle, you don't find yourself, you know, with your neck underneath the sword, just like many forgotten soldiers and forgotten villagers in times past.
It seems like just at first brush, the sort of list you rattled off there, it seems like a common theme there would be, to the extent that you are saying courts are coming up with rules to say where and why this is not an absolute right, that they're erring on the side of preserving life, which is certainly an honorable intent. Debbie's back in now. Debbie, shout at it here. We couldn't understand a word you were saying a couple minutes ago, so it sounds like you're perfectly clear now. Please go ahead.
Hope it's a little bit better.
Great.
I sign out and sign back in again. I wanted to encourage Greg that petitions do, I think, make a little bit of a difference. And there's another website besides change.org, Avaaz, AVAAZ.org, community petitions. And there was one that I got today. I don't even live in the EU, but they're preparing legislation to make it illegal to grow crops that are not on the list of approved seeds, like Monsanto and the others, basically removing natural heirloom seeds from the marketplace. And I think this has not been up there for very long, 81,000 signers. And so if you can get a lot of people behind you, number one, to make that video, if that video can go viral, you can get hundreds of thousands, if not a million, viewers. So it's going to have to spread person by person, different groups, people who are interested in this, and why it will make a difference in their life. They have to learn that. That's going to be a really big part of it. If they think it's just some kind of legal ease, then they're not really going to understand it. So I'm sure that you're going to make it really down to earth.
Yeah, I'm trying. And including personal interest stories in the video. Like, in an infamous case last year. This was reported by Michael Harris, who is the executive director for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And he reported how a misguided social worker forcefully removed a newborn from the mother's care at the hospital. And this was just hours after birth. Healthcare workers took away a newborn from the mother simply because the mother refused a hepatitis B shot.
And so there's many of those stories that you've got.
Yeah. And once attorneys step in on behalf of the family, you know, these things do get corrected, fortunately, but it just goes to show that what was missing there was clear direction for the healthcare worker. Somehow that person got into their mind that they had that power, and they do not have that power. And so what we need to do is...
I would say in that particular instance it was certainly an abuse of power and authority, but they do generally have the authority to decide to step in and intervene if, in their professional opinion, a child is being put at risk. But there is no imminent risk for a newborn to not get a hepatitis B shot because it doesn't even address something that's a risk for a newborn, and that's what's so absurd about the whole hepatitis B issue. Clearly, abuse of power and overstepping. Greg, this is something that I've had gradually over time gotten more and more insights to. Sometimes I'm slow, and this is one of those issues, but I've become increasingly clear as I've looked into it further over recent months and years that we parents have a fundamental constitutional right to parent our children and to make medical decisions. And even if there is a law requiring, which there I think probably is in most states, a hepatitis B vaccine at or near birth, I think the parent, that would be a state law, first of all, and the parent has a federal constitutional right, I would assert, and I'd love to hear your feedback on this or thoughts, Greg, a fundamental constitutional right, I think specifically it's the 14th Amendment due process right, to make decisions regarding the care and control, and that would include medical decisions for children that would supersede, as a higher legal authority, the Constitution as compared to state law. So it would supersede a state law mandate for a hepatitis B vaccine unless and up to the point where getting that or not failing to get that vaccine would leave or put a child at an imminent risk of harm. Do you have any insight or understanding about that? Would you generally concur with that or have a different opinion on that?
Yeah, it's recognized under the Parents Patriae Doctrine, and this applies at both federal and state level. And what a court will do is they will look at the goal is to protect an innocent third party, which would be a child here. And so the courts basically have a test that they use. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, they'll look at interest, like the child's emotional impact. Obviously, there's a right to self-determination, but they will basically balance it for the best interest of the child. And so in court, you would just the parent would try to show there's no imminent harm, and the medical official would try to show that there is an imminent harm, presumably if they're trying to take away the child from the parent. And once you strip that custody, then parent's patriae shifts. No longer does the parent have custody. And then if the parent doesn't have custody, who does? It's either a family member willing to follow the state rule or the state. And once that authority shifts, then it's clear. And you can look at a case like Pierce versus Pierce 268 U.S. 510 is an example where they discussed this. They sustain the parent's authority to provide religious instead of secular schooling, and they recognize the child's right to receive it, and they compared the state's requirement of attending public schools and weighed it. So you can start to see that the courts will recognize that there's a private realm of family life which the state cannot enter, And the state is only called to enter if there is some kind of immediate threat or substantial danger of harm and stuff like that. So it's, you know, which is just what we see on the ground in any state. You know, CPS never comes to take your kids away unless there's some type of, you know, again, imminent danger or something like that. So just try to stay out of that. You know, obviously try to take care of kids, stay out of that system. And number one, love your children. And keep them healthy, give them organic food, get a naturopathic doctor who can help you out. And, but yeah, you know, the rights that you have on the state and the federal level are the fundamental rights under the right to bodily integrity and parental rights on a state level and a federal level to control the medical decisions and intimate, you know, details of your family for your family. And not only you only lose that right when your kids go away, you know, at age 18, or if they petition otherwise.
But I know with religious freedom, for example, my understanding anyway is that with regard to the First Amendment right to the free exercise of religion, that parents can exercise their religion with a child up to the point where it poses a risk of imminent harm. And there's a standard in states around the country, what the law refers to as majority rule, meaning that what most states do is that as it pertains to parents in custody disputes where they disagree over religion or religious practices, that, and in fact, there was a wonderful case in state courts in California where the court did a survey of states nationally to see what states did on this issue and found that most states had one version or another of a standard where each parent or either parent or both parents can exercise their religion with the children when the child or children are with that particular parent up to the point where it's going to cause an imminent risk of harm or of course, if it would actually cause harm. And that's a pretty high bar, you know, and children, it turns out, can adapt fairly well if one parent's one religion and another parent's another religion, for example. But I wondered whether or not the same or similar standard would apply to the broader 14th Due Process Amendment to parent one's children, which would include making medical decisions. So, for example, while one can...
Like, you can look at Troxell v. Granville, and that'll prove exactly what you just said. That's a,
right.
The U.S. Supreme Court upheld that under the Due Process Clause of the Second Amendment.
Right, right, that the parents have the right to decide absent a showing that the parent is unfit. And unless there is such a showing, then the parents... they're presumed to be making decisions in the best interest of a child. There was a real interesting case in West Virginia recently, Greg, where a senior in high school, because the parents have religious objections to vaccines, the child was not allowed to go to school because West Virginia, public school, because West Virginia doesn't have a religious exemption with regard to vaccines required for school enrollment, yet... the court held that even though the child couldn't go to school and was therefore being homeschooled, that the state still had to provide the child an education. I presume, looking at the interface or conflict in this instance between the federal free exercise right and the state constitutional right to public education, I thought it was a real interesting situation.
Yeah.
And I wondered, again, if there were a same or similar standard with regard to, again, the larger constitutional right to parent or children. You know, you have the right to refuse vaccines for religious exemptions in any state. You just may not have the right to go to a public school because you have that right. But you have, as a parent, the right to make medical decisions for your child, but making certain decisions may come along with some limitations.
Well, you know, an interesting field of cases came up where the parent decided to go with a natural healing approach, and then the child died subsequently. And then the state decided to prosecute the parent for criminal negligence. And there's one. Let me give you an example. It's go to State versus Chenoweth in Indiana. In this case, there was for the state, it's going after the parents, saying, you know, you got to put the kid in the, you know, in the institution. The parents said, no, I have a right, parental right, to rely on natural healing. And what the judge didn't even, they didn't even let it go to a jury. They said, this is categorically, the parent has this right to do this. And so they directed the verdict of acquittal for the parent. So the jury was not even allowed to decide whether that parent was criminally negligent. It was clear that the parent was within their authority to rely on natural healing. But for
do you know anything about the facts about how the child died? Because I could certainly imagine a situation where a parent, under a pretense, whether ultimately false or not by definitions, under a pretense of doing natural healing, but what truly would have been negligent in some obvious way. But I could just as easily imagine, depending on, you know, the actual facts, a parent behaving very reasonably and still having a horrible result.
Yeah, and you can find for every case that you find, you know, explaining the Chenoweth rationale, you can find as many cases that will conclude the opposite, that a parent can be prosecuted if they don't put their kid in the system. So what you have is a dichotomy, and
gotcha.
You've got to watch out. You know, you just don't know how that gavel is going to fall on you, from state to state.
And that's kind of scary, because I hear from parents all the time, Greg, or certainly intermittently over the long term, you know, on a regular basis, who themselves or sometimes they're talking about other people they've known about, where it's so ironic where parents who take the extra time and trouble to do research and come up with a very reasonable conclusion in many instances that a so-called complementary or alternative approach is probably a smarter approach to a particular healthcare issue with a child. I even talked to some parents once who went overseas to get a specific treatment for their child that was not available in the U.S., again, after considerable research and deliberation, and they were later prosecuted for kidnapping their own child.
Oh, my gosh.
For going overseas to get a medical or an alternative treatment for their child. And how bizarre. I don't know what else to other word to call it. Because, you know, in many instances, the alternative treatment by any rational objective measure would be either anywhere from perfectly reasonable to clearly the preferred approach if you're looking for what's best for the child's health and well-being. But if you're dealing with authorities who take a hard line, medical doctors are the end-all and be-all, and anything else is somehow misguided, negligent or whatever other legal label they want to put on it, and that occurs, at least in my understanding, with some regularity in the U.S. So it's heartening to hear you talk about this decision in the Indiana case, that there are at least some courts that will recognize a parent's right to make those decisions. And
yeah.
I think you can argue it as a starting place, argue that the right is there under the Constitution, absent, as you say in the Troxell case, absent this showing that the parent is unfit.
Oh, and I can find some blame in the Constitution on that. But that's the thing, is that the Constitution can feel so esoteric at times. Like, let me just read to you California Constitution, Section 1, okay? And you'll just get a feeling that, like, it's so lofty that you're not even sure whether it protects all of your rights or if it's just like a, you know, like what somebody says after they've had a few drinks. Okay, here we go. All people are by nature free and independent and have inalienable rights. Among these are enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy. You know? So there you go. You know, here, that just protects everything that we should have. You know, this would answer the question of whether a parent could be prosecuted. You know, it should answer all sorts of privacy questions, but in experience, we know that it doesn't, that the police power is constantly intruding on these fundamental rights, and sometimes for very good reason, you know, because people are often, you know, can't trust criminals, you know, so many dangerous conditions, people will neglect their children oftentimes. I mean, you got to be so, vigilant as a law enforcement officer and in our institutions. But every now and then we come across these heart-wrenching cases where somebody does get churned by the system and they didn't deserve it. And I think, you know, the more I research, the more I just see we're just part of this saga. It's meant to be this kind of drama of competing rights, and I hope that we do to others what we would want done to us.
In your case, Alan, that you mentioned, you said that the person was prosecuted for kidnapping. Who would do such a thing? Another person or the state? Who would prosecute?
That would probably have been a criminal case, and it would be a district attorney or local state official prosecuting the case, if I understand correctly. So
they probably go ahead because of some family member complains. It's going to be like a disgruntled mother-in-law or something like that, and they say they're not taking care of the kid, and they know the prosecution office or something like that. I mean, that's how these things start. Yeah. If both parents are on board to take the child overseas for medical treatment, that's completely within their rights. And it only becomes an issue if you have another relative who's going to complain and has some clout in some way.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. Let me take a quick moment here. Just absolutely fascinating discussion as always, Greg. You've been listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and today, special guest, attorney Greg Glazer from California. Debbie, I want to give you a moment to chime in here because we're at the half-hour mark for the last half hour of the show, and I wanted to know whether you had a homeopathy section planned today or if you wanted to carry on the discussion here. I want to put that ball in your court for a moment because I don't want to just walk over the line here. Inappropriately.
We can do either way. I have prepared some on dealing with stress, specifically financial stress, and some homeopathic remedies. Otherwise, we can just go ahead and continue. I did want to mention that on Monday coming up, Dr. Deepak Sharma of New Delhi will talk about how homeopathy may help heal fibroids and uterine growth. That's going to be the upcoming subject on the Health In Video, live video show at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Nissan Communications Network. And otherwise, we can continue talking if Greg has a whole bunch more to talk about. And whatever time's left, I can just mention about homeopathy and some remedies.
Okay. Well, I'm going to need to, as gracefully as I can, bow out shortly. But, Greg, I am absolutely totally open to you taking whatever additional time you'd like to at this point to either bring up any other points that you had prepared for today or to otherwise provide any sort of summary or closing sort of comments. And This is, like so many of the topics we get into with you, Greg, this is one just full of opportunity to expand and explore and expound upon in your future visits, and I hope you'll come back again soon to do that. But please take us where you'd like to from this point.
Sure. Yeah. I'll just quickly summarize, and then I'll plan on coming back as a guest again as I have been, and look forward to picking up the discussion. So to summarize what we talked about today, you have the right to be peacefully natural, and you may find yourself in a situation where a government official does not recognize that right, and they may have some legal justification, in particular some type of fact sheet put out by the by a regulatory body that says that they have the right to forcibly medicate you in an emergency. In that event, hopefully you have your exemption form together and you have a doctor's recommendation. Our the current state of law is that there is quite a bit of uncertainty as to where the lines are. Now is a great time for attorneys to get involved, as well as the public, to petition for change, to draw some clear lines that would support everyone involved, because law enforcement benefits from having certainty in this realm as well. And I'm going to propose some specific tools for change soon, one being the PANDA referendum through change.org, and another hopefully being the flowchart for law enforcement. And thank you guys for having me on today.
Right. So one thing we would like to know, how people can contact you and ask you further questions or join you in your referendum and the development of the flowchart. So let folks know how to contact you.
Sure. Yeah, the best way to find me is through my website, civilactionnetwork.org.
Civilactionnetwork.org.
Yes.
Oh, I always like to repeat web addresses one or two times so that we can give people an opportunity to make sure they've got it.
Yeah. Oh, and pandemicresponseproject.com.
Yeah, Greg has made some wonderful wonderful contributions to the Pandemic Response Project, for which I'm just immensely grateful, Greg, and glad to have you as a partner out there in the world generally, and then specifically with the things you've done on your own initiatives and then supporting the Pandemic Response Project as well. It's really terrific. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate it.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, Debbie, I think we're ready to turn it over to you.
Okay, so I will take the last bit of time. And how can people contact you, Alan?
Oh, I am available at vaccinerights.com. Email and phone contact information on every page of vaccinerights.com. And, of course, encourage folks who have any questions or concerns about their right to legally refuse vaccines to start their search at vaccinerights.com. A lot of good information there. Reliable information to help people in that arena.
Okay, and as soon as that change.org petition is out there, we will inform the public and let them know and tweet it and Facebook it and let folks gather some energy toward that proposal that you will have. Okay.
That's right, Greg. Keep us up to speed with that, and we'll support your efforts.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate that.
All right, take care.
Take
Debbie,
care.
It's all yours.
Yes, okay, so now I'm going to be talking about stress, because that is an issue that we have to deal with on a daily basis. And getting in touch with our body, getting in touch with how we feel and what our little thoughts are inside of our head that are turning us to some kind of panic situation or anxiety, and what kind of homeopathic remedies you might be able to use. Specifically today, I'm going to be talking about financial stress. You know, people who watch the stock market and constantly trigger anxiety within themselves because they're looking at the money that they're either losing or wish they had or don't have. And the cost of living today, all of that can really induce some stress within ourselves. We can have excessive worry, and that can come out in actual physical symptoms that we have, where you end up running to the doctor for palpitations or heart, chest pain, difficulty breathing, even having trembling or sweating, excessive perspiration, having that lump in the throat, being unable to communicate, feeling like you're on the verge of Alzheimer's with memory loss or forgetfulness, that all different things, not being able to sleep really deeply and well, having all kinds of fears, like fears of public speaking and fears that things are going to go wrong, fears about the unknown or your future, feeling indecisive, being indecisive. And I recently was watching a TED Talk by someone who was talking about making decisions, and possibly the reason of being indecisive today is because we have so many choices. And if you're able to limit those choices and narrow them down, you'll be able to make more clear, more decisive decisions, making a choice in things. Then you can have vertigo, dizziness, loss of appetite, stomach pain. In a way, it almost sounds like a child who is going to school on the first day and having those fears and those anxieties. A person can have gas and difficulty in their digestion with pain in their stomach or diarrhea or constipation, nausea or indigestion. All of these different symptoms could be related to stress, and specifically as an individual, to financial stress. And the doctor, if you go to the doctor because you're having these kinds of symptoms, might prescribe for you things that will supposedly be muscle relaxers or emotional tension relaxers, or psychologically feeling that, you know, you're having these problems, and prescribe some heavy-duty medications, clorazepam or clorpromazine or diazepam, or all different kinds of medications that in one sense might initially remove the disturbance, help you sleep a little bit better. Over time, you might notice that you will have a rebound, you'll have more anxiety with more insomnia, possibly nightmares or dry mouth, fatigue, inability to communicate or other kinds of social interactions, having such really pretty bad anxiety and even to depression and inability to stay awake. So what kind of homeopathic remedies might come in handy? There is a whole gamut, a whole list of remedies, and I'm going to go through as many as I can today, and you're going to hear familiar remedies that we have talked about in the past on previous shows for stress reduction. The first one that I'm going to talk about is aconite, Aconitum napellus, and that's one for a person who's undergoing a panic attack, and that comes on pretty suddenly. And I'm going to just put you on hold to breathe just for a moment. Just breathe out and count to 10. And I'm back here, and that is the panic attack for aconite. And so if you are stressed out because I left the microphone for a minute, it's because you need company or you need to hear a voice. That might deal with another remedy. But if you have this strong fear, homeopathy might come in handy for that really anxiety with the palpitations, shortness of breath, flushing of face, and sometimes you'll even be jittery or shaking as if you've had too many cups of coffee. And besides working well for flus and colds, it just could be a general anxiety. That's aconite. The next remedy I'm going to list is Argentum nitricum, and this can also be good for anxiety, especially before a big event, so anticipation anxiety. So if you're hanging on to that stock market and wondering what's going to crash next, this might come in handy for taking an exam or a job interview, for that public speaking engagement, or even to go to an event where there are going to be other people around, a social engagement where you might think that you have some expectation to perform or speak. Again, physically, you could have dizziness and diarrhea along with this anxiety. These people often are very suggestible and enthusiastic, and they might even be impulsive. Typically, one of the keynotes, and a keynote is something that would really lead you to select a remedy, would be their desire for sweets and salts. But specifically, we think about really loving sweets. If there was a choice on that table for potato chips or something sweet like candy, you know that they're going to choose the candy. Always, whenever you're listening to me speak on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, The Health In Show, or on homeopathyworldcommunity.com or Facebook, this is information that is out there on the internet for anybody to search, seek, educate themselves, and learn. This is not giving you medical advice. This is educational, entertainment, information for you to enlarge your scope of knowledge. So we're talking about these different remedies right now, dealing with anxiety and fears and that stress that comes from not feeling good within yourself. The next remedy for intense nervousness is arsenicum album. These worry warts really worry about their finances. Security is a very important issue. Even if they're in a good financial situation, they're still counting their pennies. They're still very cautious with how much money they spend because they have this underlying fear of poverty, that it could happen at any moment. And, you know, in reality, it could happen at any moment. But for them, it is so real that it worries their day. And that anxiety is seen as changing or affecting their health. Every little thing about them that they notice that comes out, whether it's something on the skin or something that happens to a neighbor or somebody else in this family, they're going to have their mind just goes full speed ahead and they think the worst. And that's why they worry so much. Those people, in order to keep order in their life, are extremely meticulous and cleanliness is of the highest order. They also love company and to be around others for security. Plus, physically, they are typically chilly in their temperature, and they want to drink small sips of cold water. The other remedy that's next is Bryonia alba. These folks are constantly talking about their business, constantly worried about finances and money. Again, they do also fear poverty and financial ruin. When they are under stress, they become irritable. They want to be left alone because any movement or motion will disturb them. And that is one of the keynotes for Bryonia album. And that is that they are better left alone and without any kind of motion to cause them to feel any type of pains, whether it's a migraine or a headache or physical injury pains, difficulty breathing, coughs and colds. This is another remedy that has kinds of body aches and pains and stiffness and feels much better when they're resting in a quiet space. Differentially, the arsenicum album likes little sips of water, but Bryonia alba type of personality will have great big gulps of water. Calcarea carbonicum is another remedy for concerns, worries, and excessive anxiety about their finances and their security. It is like the people who will clam up, and they're very, very cautious about what they do in terms of taking risks in life, and especially with their finances. They're going to be the savers in the bunch. And they also worry a lot about, excuse me, the other folks in their family, their loved ones. For physicals, these folks sweat quite a bit. They're clammy and have problems with constipation. They can't very well watch the news because it causes them so much further worry and concern when they see anything bad happening in the news. So they probably won't be watching television. These people can be very strong, as on the other hand, besides being feeling insecure, they can be very dependable, hardworking people who accomplish a lot in their life. The next remedy we're going to talk about is Ignatia, Ignatia Amara, again, for anxiety loss. So we have this as our major remedy for grief of losing a loved one, moving away, losing their home, where they've settled in and planted everything, losing something that they have in a child, like the blanket or a doll, or whether it's your book or something that you had that you lost. So you can imagine it would also pertain to financial loss and stress with financial loss. These folks, you might notice, physically sighing a lot. And is there somebody who's called in today? Or are you just listening? There's somebody who's called
listening.
In? Okay, thank
I'm
you.
I'm listening.
Thanks so much. So I'm glad that we do have listeners today. I'm talking about that Ignatia for loss. And it's the first one we think about if there has been any kind of loss in the family. A person might, it was used typically for hysteria, for laughter and tears, and for headaches that feel like a nail driven through the side of the head, or cramps that things are contrary in this personality type that needs Ignatia. So if you have a lump in the throat, you don't think that you could swallow, but it actually feels better by eating. The next remedy is Cali Phosphoricum. When a person is very exhausted, they have worked themselves, they are feeling deep anxiety and inability to cope, and Cali Phos is just for this nervousness, jumpiness, oversensitivity, startling with every noise and loud sound. Again, similar to Calcarea Carb, they will not be able to deal too well with unpleasant news, with thinking about the world's problems, which is something that we get every single day, especially today talking about Syria. I mean, and talking about our vaccination issues, our health issues. So Calc Phos is something that can also be found in your regular health food store in a very low potency cell salt of the 6X. And taken for a little while to see if it helps with the insomnia or inability to concentrate, that just general nervousness and even nervous indigestion. Moving on to another remedy for indigestion would be Lycopodium. These people suffer so much from their lack of confidence and self-esteem, and it all resides in their digestion with a lot of bloating and gas. Anxiety there when they need to speak in public or perform or take a test, very similar to Argentum Nitricum, and also love sweets like Argentum Nitricum. But this one specifically has a tremendous amount of indigestion, constipation, gas, irritability, and again, that bloating. They can end up at home, in a place where they feel more secure and comfortable, being a bully type, or even in school or at work being a bully type, but it really comes from their personal insecurity. Natrum Muriaticum is another remedy for this problem with insecurity and stress with finances, and again, it's very much related to the Ignatia remedy that is for loss and grief. These folks, Natrum Muriaticum, are martyrs in our society. They keep to themselves all of their concerns and worries. They don't let it out so much. They kind of suppress all of those emotional pains and hurts that they've had. And if they've had a loss in finances, they're not about usually to be blabbering about it. They're just going to figure it out for themselves and figure out a way to deal with it. And yet they're really under a heavy deal of stress. Socially, they might shy away from company. And they might turn to alcohol or some other self-medication, and there are other remedies that would do this too. They are easily hurt and offended, and one of the types of people that can bear a grudge. So if they've been in a financial conflict, you might not be hearing from this type of person again, because they're just going to bottle it up within themselves. The next remedy, and one of the things about, I mentioned some of those drugs that you might be prescribed for insomnia, Nitro-muriatica might be helpful for both the insomniac and for folks who are getting the very bad headaches like migraines. And as I'm leading into Nux Vomica, we've got just a couple minutes left of today's show. Nux Vomica would be a type who might self-medicate through drinking alcohol or just becoming a workaholic. They're very goal-driven and competitive. They like to win, and if they lose, they're going to become quite irritable and even aggressive. They might be smoking and drinking coffee nonstop and taking stimulants, and you know that's going to lead to indigestion, heartburn, GERD, allergies, fatigue, and just general burning out. Another remedy is phosphorus, and I'm running out of time to do all of these remedies today. Phosphorus is a remedy for a very sensitive individual, very easily excited, and not really being able to define their boundaries between themselves and the other people around them. One other remedy for that financial stress would be Serinum. This requires help from your professional expert homeopath. It's P-S-O-R-I-N-U-M. And that's because it's a nosode. That means it comes from a diseased matter. And those folks also have that fear of poverty. That seems to be a key note for this issue of financial loss, fear of in matters of finances, money, and stress. So with 2 minutes left to the show, I want to let you know again that on Monday, we're going to have on the Health In Show, nissancommunications.com. Just go to homeopathyworldcommunity.com to learn more about it, or on Facebook. We're going to let you know, and I haven't put up the announcement yet. Dr. Deepak Sharma, my regular co-host from New Delhi, is going to talk about fibroids and uterine growth and how homeopathy can help with these female problems. Last week, we had on Gina Tyler talking about autism and homeopathy in her pediatric clinic in Thailand that she went to this summer to help train another physician. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com. That's me, Debbie Brooke. And I want to thank so much Alan Phillips for being my co-host here on Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. each Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We're usually simulcasting through Freedomizer Radio. And I also want to thank Greg Glazer of CivilActionNetwork.org from California for chiming in with his knowledge about constitutional law. I'm going to wish everyone a very pleasant and beautiful day, a stress-free day. Simply just breathe and think about what your mind is talking to you, and get to the root of the problem. Write in your journal. That's something that I usually tell folks to do. Put down your thoughts so that you can notice where they're traveling or what the theme is behind your motivations each day. And visit us at Homeopathy World Community. I like to post some positive thoughts, inspirational and motivational thoughts. And we will see you next Monday on the Health Inn and next Thursday on Blog Talk Radio. Once a month, we do have Christina Chambreau talking about vaccinations, not vaccinations, about pet health and homeopathy. So I'm going to leave you today without any ending music, just signing off and wishing you a great day.